The Trump administration is preparing to build its promised border wall, but it's not starting from scratch. Barriers already exist. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio, and this is Fronteras, a public radio show about issues along the U.S.-Mexico border and changing demographics in the Southwest. KPBS in San Diego and iNews Source obtained government records detailing those barriers and their impact over time. It's believed to be the most comprehensive look at the border that's ever been done. The existing barriers were built almost entirely by two Democratic and one Republican administration. In a report called America's Wall, KPBS investigative reporter Jean Guerrero takes a look at the wall's history.
Before President Trump's promise of a wall, there was America's wall.
Our administration has moved aggressively to secure our borders more.
The United States must secure its borders. This is a basic responsibility of a sovereign nation.
We have strengthened border security beyond what many believed was possible.
The Clinton, Bush, and Obama administrations built 97% of America's wall. It's made of steel columns, razor wire, and in some places even helicopter landing mats from the Vietnam War. The wall stretches for 653 miles, but it still covers far less than half of the border. Trump promised to build an impenetrable wall.
We're going to have strong, incredible borders. We're going to build a wall. It's going to be built.
But he now plans to focus on rebuilding the existing wall, starting in San Diego. So KPBS and iNews Source teamed up to find out. Has the wall been doing its job of reducing illegal immigration and drug trafficking? Using multiple Freedom of Information Act requests, we were able to layer data about the wall's construction over time with records of illegal traffic. Our data shows a conspicuous pattern. Over time, America's wall has reduced smuggling wherever it's been built, but it has shifted those flows elsewhere, into gaps between the barriers, into the ocean, into the sky, and even underground. David Shirk of the University of San Diego studies cross-border smuggling.
The wall simply ensures that there will be ever more creative ways of getting around it.
Here's an example. San Diego doubled its fencing in the 90s. As a result, in the neighboring El Centro sector, the share of apprehensions rose 500%. Shirk says a stronger, taller wall will still be vulnerable.
It's like a giant game of whack-a-mole. Right, they whack them over here and they pop up over there.
Smugglers have used ramps, catapults, and taller ladders to get over the fence.
East of Don Roos, about 150 yards north.
Joshua Wilson of the National Border Patrol Council says a stronger wall will help.
Every layer of security we put up is another layer of security they have to spend time trying to defeat, and it allows us the ability to more effectively interdict them.
But Wilson says there are areas that the wall doesn't address at all. The ocean is one of them.
We've had people try and swim across, surf across, scuba dive, jet ski. There's no end to the creativity of the people trying to come here illegally.
During the peak years of border fence construction between 2008 and 2009, apprehensions in the Pacific Ocean rose 74%. Our records also show that when fence construction sped up, so did tunneling. Officials are finding increasingly sophisticated tunnels with elevators and rail systems. And now, smugglers have started using drones. This summer, San Diego Border Patrol sector caught its first drone, carrying 13 pounds of methamphetamine. Shirk of the University of San Diego says a truly impenetrable wall would cost more than the U.S. can afford.
There's no cost-efficient way to build a wall that's going to achieve our goals.
The existing wall cost at least $7 billion to build. Estimates for how much Trump's wall would cost range from as low as $12 billion to more than $20 billion. And researchers believe that unless Trump can address the natural gaps in America's wall, the patterns in its history will likely repeat. For Fronteras, I'm Jean Guerrero.
Buying or renting a home is a bedrock part of the American experience. But 31% of Latinos report they faced discrimination when looking for a house or apartment. That's another finding in a recent NPR study done in conjunction with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Health. NPR's Chris Arnold reports.
About a year ago, Gustavo Dwai and Laura Smith were looking to find a house to rent. They live in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. He's a geologist and he's from Venezuela. She's a high school English teacher and grew up in Alabama. And they just gotten married.
We're living in this super, super, super tiny house. We had all of our wedding presents and just too many things in it.
And one day they saw a bigger house in the neighborhood come up for rent.
And when we saw the for rent sign, I pushed Gustavo to call and look into it.
I left a voicemail. I said, my name is Gustavo. I live in the neighborhood, but I'm interested in moving into another home. And that I was a young married guy looking for a place to live.
But he didn't hear back.
He called her back a week later, something like that. And she didn't return his call.
So after not hearing back twice,
I said, I don't want to make any assumptions here, but I was like, why don't you give him a call and see if you get a call back? And she left a message saying, you know, this is Laura. I live in the neighborhood. Just kind of a similar message.
And when I called and said my name, which sounds very white, the woman texted me back like within 5 minutes.
And we just kind of looked at each other and I kind of started, you know, laughing. Hey, this kind of stuff happens all the time. But she got really upset.
I had a much stronger reaction. I was livid. The only different information she had between the two voicemails were our names. His first name is Gustavo, which is his Hispanic name. And I was horrified.
According to our poll, about one third of Latino respondents said they had experienced some form of housing discrimination at some point in their lives. That's a striking number, but
this happens much less than it used to.
Stephen Ross is an economist at the University of Connecticut. He's done research where pairs of so-called testers, white, black, Latino researchers, pose as people looking for a home. He says in the year 2000, a study found that nearly 7% of the time, Latinos were told that apartments were not available to rent when in fact they were, and white people were shown the units. But 12 years later, that happened only 2% of the time, a big improvement. That's not to say that he thinks that discrimination isn't a problem anymore.
I know every month the Connecticut Fair Housing Center in Connecticut finds clear evidence of discrimination and takes those landlords to court.
But Ross says over the past 30 years, enforcement efforts like this around the country have made a real impact. Still, even if it's less common these days, when it does happen, housing discrimination can be damaging and in some ways that you might not expect. Dr. Megan Sandel is a pediatrician and researcher at Boston Medical Center.
A safe, decent, affordable apartment can act like a vaccine. It can keep you healthy now and in the future.
Sandel says she's not just talking about is there lead paint or toxins in the house, but is the neighborhood safe? Are the schools good? What are the norms expected of young people? Do they go to college?
And that has huge implications for your income and ultimately your life expectancy. Your zip code may be more important to your health than your genetic code.
Sandel's hospital is in Roxbury. It's a lower income neighborhood in Boston with a large minority population.
Right outside of our door here at Boston Medical Center, the average life expectancy is 58 years. You travel 3 miles down to the Back Bay and the life expectancy is 91 years. And so we know that that is based on your environment.
Likewise, kids are more likely to have higher stress and more health problems in lower income neighborhoods like this. So Sandel says if Latinos and other ethnic groups are being discriminated against and more end up in troubled neighborhoods,
that's wrong. And we need to think about ways in which to solve it.
For their part, Gustavo Dwy and Laura Smith bought a bigger house this past spring. But Gustavo says when the topic comes up, Laura still gets upset about it even more than he does.
She hasn't stopped telling her family and her friends about it. And she's on my side, which is great.
Chris Arnold, NPR News.
Chris Arnold's report originally aired November 2nd on NPR's All Things Considered. Discrimination has long been an issue in the film industry. People of color have struggled to increase their ranks in front of and behind the camera. What can be done to increase the involvement of African Americans, Asians, Latinos, and Native Americans? The question of inclusion is central to Albuquerque's fourth annual Pueblo Film Fest taking place this weekend. The festival offers Pueblo filmmakers a place to tell their stories and share their perspective. The event's organizer, Bettina Sandoval of the Indian Pueblo Cultural Center, talked with KUNM's Spencer Beck about the festival's goals.
The festival, of course, includes films. There are about a dozen of them, but also events designed to benefit Pueblo filmmakers.
Yeah. So the first 3 years were just films and sometimes panels. We had a lot of feedback saying they really liked the panels. They liked seeing Pueblo filmmakers. And so this year we thought, why don't we add Q&As to the film fest so that people are able to interact and engage with filmmakers. And then we're actually going to have workshops run by Pueblo people who are involved in film. So our youth can see that there are people who are in these positions and that they can be in these positions too.
And this festival is focusing specifically on Pueblo people.
Yes, but there are other filmmakers that we've included, Navajo, Apache, other tribes, but it's always something that's relatable to the Pueblo culture, lifestyle, the Southwest.
Since working on this festival, Bettina, has the way you look at films about Native Americans changed?
It's kind of a mix of, you know, I'm glad that there's these films out there, and it makes me really want to promote them and to get people to watch them. And I wish that it was more mainstream, a lot of these films, you know, because what is mainstream, what's seen as a Native film is just, it's not respectful most of the time. It's not accurate, you know. Number one, there's so many different tribes in the United States, and we all get lumped together as one tribe or one type of culture, and that's all the education that people have on Native Americans.
Have you had good response from the Pueblo filmmaking professionals to your requests?
Yeah, we met with some of them and got some of our ideas from them on running the workshops. And over the years, it's mainly been us seeking films. And just last year was the first time that we had a submission form put online. This year, we got quite a bit more submissions. So the Pueblo Film Fest is getting really well known lately. A lot of people are enthusiastic about it, and they're actually making films for the film fest.
What's the best thing right now that can happen to Native American or Pueblo filmmakers?
Getting their film out there, telling their story, because that's what they really want to do, is share their perspective. You know, that's who we are. We like to tell stories, and, you know, I see this as another method of storytelling.
That was Bettina Sandoval of the Indian Pueblo Cultural Center in Albuquerque talking with KUNM's Spencer Beckwith. Coming up next on Fronteras, as San Antonio's tricentennial approaches, people are tracing their Spanish history.
I found that King Ferdinand was my 14th great-grandfather.
Digging into San Antonio's roots when we come back. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio. Welcome back to Fronteras. San Antonio is on the verge of celebrating its tricentennial, 300 years since the Presidio de Béjar, the Villa de Béjar, and the Misión Valero were settled by soldiers, civilians, and priests in 1718. A lot of South Texans who descended from those Spanish settlers can trace their ancestry back three centuries to that time and beyond. For those who can't, though, a nonprofit is making it easier to follow the family tree. I had a chance to talk with archaeologist Sergio Iruegas and Melinda Tate Iruegas, and with the president and creator of the 1718 San Antonio Founding Families, Joanne Gonzalez Murphy, who has discovered her roots trace back to 1718 and even further back to Spanish royalty.
Performing my own genealogical research, I come to find that I have some ancestors within that time. My family tree came with the Spanish land grant with José de Escandón, who was, I guess, portioning out these land grants. Our family received a portion. There were a lot of family members, and it would get divided and subdivided. And so by the time my father inherited that about 40 years ago, he had to go back to the Railroad Commission just to find out, wait a minute, you know, just to check its accuracy because it didn't appear to be right. And so within that, we were able to expand and the tree flourished. I found that King Ferdinand was my 14th great-grandfather in 1492. Juan Ponce de Leon, who brought in the first longhorn into the Americas, is my 13th great-grandfather. So we're able to share information now and create this you know, this network, and we're putting these pieces together and now forming and sharing the story of not only our families, but of how San Antonio came to be. So we decided just informally to begin a group to represent the history 1718 and surrounding. Next year is our tricentennial. So this group will hopefully launch itself to better promote the history, and it's open to the public. It's open to general members and direct descendants and indirect descendants.
And so, Melinda, you worked with a lot of the archival material. What kind of information do you see when you're going through all these records? Because the Spanish, I understand, were very good at keeping records, and that's why it's sometimes not so difficult for so many people to trace their ancestry back here in South Texas.
The bureaucracy is amazing. They not only document that when people were born, when people died, when people were married, the diaries of the entradas that came in through Texas, all of that provides the basis for us learning and knowing about the 1718 group. One of my favorite sayings in San Antonio is everybody's cousins. Everybody is related.
The phrase in Spanish is somos primos. Nosotros somos primos. We're all cousins. There's interrelations that go back in the family tree.
And so, Sergio, there's a lot of history that actually goes on beyond 1718, including the original naming of San Antonio. And what were the circumstances surrounding the actual naming of? And what was the instance that led to the founding of?
Yes, so in 1716, Captain Domingo Ramon and Fray Isidro Felix de Espinosa had arrived here in San Antonio. In fact, the written records of their diaries describe it as a post. So people already knew, in particular the French, knew of the villages here in the San Antonio area along the Yanaguana River. That's what the native Cuauhtecan speakers called the river. Eventually,
the San Antonio River.
The San Antonio River, correct. And in 1716, Ramon and Espinosa are on their way to East Texas. In 1718, more people are brought over. There's a total of 10 families. There's a total of 72 people that eventually are here in 1716. So by between 1716 and 1731, just looking at the Mission Valero records alone, just those records, there were an estimated 574 individuals living here. That does not count the 169 individuals that were already buried here.
So geographically, where would you say that all of this centered around? Is it sort of where we know the Alamo to be?
Yes, within the big bend of the San Antonio River and La Villita, the east side of the river, of the San Antonio River, is where the permanent mission location was at. So everything within the bend of the San Antonio River, all of that area was the original settlement, and then the outskirts. And many of the streets have the names of the people who came here in the first place. Flores Street, Navarro, South Presa. Presa means the dam, so it's the road going to the southern dam. So if we look at even the cartography of San Antonio, we can also see history that way.
And so, Joanne, you have a really deep connection to your heritage, and you can trace it back several generations. And I've noticed that from speaking to a lot of people here in South Texas, they have just that connection to their past. And in other places around the state, you're going to find people, you know, like myself, who probably can't name an ancestor, past, or grandmother. So how did you discover your heritage? What brought you into that area of interest?
It wasn't until a few years ago, my brother had given me the tree just to hold for security. And I started thumbing through it, and I opened it up, and I saw all these names with all these dates going back to 1400s. These are family members, but I need to validate for myself that this is correct. with that opened up this great story, that led throughout the whole North America, New Mexico, into Tejas. And I felt very strongly that it's something that we needed to share with the community at large. And in doing so, I realized that, well, I probably should start to reach out to those professionals such as Sergio and his wife Melinda, registered professional archaeologists, to help narrow down the story and refine the story and bring about accurate information for this group so that we can relay that to the community. So we're trying to connect with other institutions and entities that will have this information and help us research accurately in a professional manner so that we acquire appropriate, substantial information and continue to build on that.
That was my conversation with Joanne Gonzalez-Murphy, founder and president of the 1718 San Antonio Founding Families, and with archaeologists Sergio Iruegas and Melinda Tate Iruegas. And that's it for Fronteras and our stories from the Southwest this week. You can find the show under the Programs tab on our website, tpr.org. Alexis Yancey produced the broadcast, and Michelle Dubach is our executive producer. Cheranga Cakewalk composed our theme music. Thanks for joining us. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.